Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, on this 26th of November 2014, I'm very pleased to welcome to the programme Tony Zambotti, who is a mechanical engineer and a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. A US Navy veteran, Tony holds a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Villanova University and has spent the last 28 years working predominantly in the aerospace industry. He has authored or co-authored a number of peer-reviewed articles published by the esteemed Journal of 9/11 Studies and was one of the experts featured in the documentary by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth called 9/11 Explosive Evidence: Experts Speak Out. Tony, welcome to the program. Good to speak to you.
Nice to be here, Julian.
Now, the reason why I invited you to join us on the program was because a couple of weeks ago, I was contacted by a colleague of yours who's a member of your team of engineers that's been looking into the 9/11 World Trade Center collapses. And he drew my attention to a white paper that you've recently published. And this is by various members of the Architects and Engineers 9/11 Truth. And this paper is called Areas of Specific Concern in the NIST WTC Reports. And that paper lists 25 points, which you say offers the most convincing proof that the WTC collapse reports produced by the US National Institute of Standards and Technology are, and I'm going to use the words that are appended to that report, that those reports are unscientific and fraudulent. And this colleague of yours suggested that you would be the person to come on and tell us about that document and the implications it has for complaint and possibly legal action. So that's what we're going to be talking about. But Tony, could we start with you personally, just so we've got a clearer idea about your work and experience? I mean, you say that you've been working in the aerospace industry for 28 years or so. So could you give us an idea of what kind of work you're involved in with that?
Yeah, mostly aircraft equipment and structures, and also satellite equipment and structures. In addition to that, I also worked, I say predominantly because I also worked at what was RCA Broadcast, which wasn't far from where I live here in southern New Jersey. They actually designed and built the antenna stack that was on the North Tower of the World Trade Center. I worked there from 1992 to 1994. So that was heavy structural work in addition to aerospace work I've been involved in besides that.
Was it that connection that you had there that prompted you to start looking at the collapses?
Actually, no, it wasn't. What prompted me to start looking at the collapses was, I was working at actually BAE Systems here in the States on September 11, 2001. And we were in a design review with another company that's got British ties, Alenia Marconi. We had designed something for them, and we were in a design review, and somebody got a call on a cell phone that one of the World Trade Center towers was hit. And, you know, you're thinking it's a Cessna or something like that, a small aircraft. And 15 minutes later, got another call that another aircraft hit, and they were big aircraft. At that point, you knew something was not right. And at 9:30, we had a break, and we were right next to the cafeteria. And big companies generally have TVs in the cafeteria nowadays, or in the last 20 years or so. And so we went to the cafeteria and watched the TV, and everybody's, you know, you see the tower smoking at that point. And it wasn't long, you know, just less than a half hour later, the South Tower, which was the second one hit, came down. Mm. And, you know, it was just a shocking thing. And then, you know, we didn't go back right away, and everybody was milling around. And he saw the North Tower come down. I just looked at it, and you know, you're in shock to some degree, and I couldn't understand where all the energy came from to do that. It seemed to like flow to the ground. But I wasn't suspicious. I'm not going to say that. I just was in shock that that could happen. And coming home that night on the radio, I heard about a third building come down. They said it was World Trade Center 7. It was called. It was 47 stories tall, and they gave some idea of its length and width. Rather large building. It was 300 foot long. It's trapezoidal, but on average, about 300 foot long and 144 foot wide. And they said it completely collapsed, and I just couldn't understand. I'm thinking it must have been right up against the towers and been completely gutted. But even still, I'm imagining myself in the basement of one of these very large buildings, you know, like a parking garage, and there's these massive concrete encased columns. How does this thing completely collapse like this? And so no aircraft hit it. I didn't know where it was located, so I was perplexed about that. Well, in 2004, I used to watch the History Channel on Sunday mornings. They had a show on called History Center that I liked, and there was a show on before that called History's Business at 8:30 to 9, and they would have past and present captains of industry, like Jack Welch from General Electric, CEOs of Southwest Airlines, people like that. So Larry Silverstein was on this show, History's Business, and Larry was the owner of World Trade Center 7, who had taken over the tower complex, the Twin Tower complex, in 2001 from the Port Authority in New York, New Jersey. He leased them for 99 years at a cost of $115 million a year. So he was on, and this had to be after, in early 2004, because they showed the new Freedom Tower, which is, it's built now, they call it the One World Trade Center. And they had had a design competition, and the thing that won, the design that won was a 1,776-foot tall building with the, that counted the antenna at the top. So they showed that design. They talked about 9/11. At the end, the host said to Larry, very matter-of-factly, he asked him a question. He says, what happened to 7? And I had been perplexed about it. Larry very matter-of-factly said Building 7 was a controlled demolition, using those words. I wasn't suspicious. It was like a head slap moment for me. I said, oh, that makes sense. And the implication, I think he even talked about, is so damaged, and for safety reasons, they took it down.
And he actually, Larry Silverstein himself, you say, used the words controlled demolition.
I would swear in a courtroom that's what he said, yes.
Is this the quote where he says that the decision was made to pull it?
No, that was on Frontline in September 2002. This had to be 2004. When I saw this, because they showed that new building design, that had to be after December 2003. Well, when he said that, and, you know, I said, oh, that made sense. I wasn't asking, you know, when would there have been a chance to set the charges or anything. I didn't think about that. I thought they could do it. And in early 2006, I heard about the physics professor from Brigham Young University bringing up issues with molten metal in the rubble of the three collapsed buildings. I didn't know about that. When I heard it, I thought, is it a quirky anomaly? I have to read his paper.
This is Stephen Jones, is it?
Yes, this is Stephen Jones, the physics professor from BYU. And he had written a paper called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse? So I'm reading the paper, and he's talking about Building 7, which is what caught his attention. And only then did I ask myself, wait a minute, when did they get a chance to set the charges in Building 7? I saw Silverstein say it was a controlled demolition. I hadn't heard anything else. I didn't even know there was a 9/11 truth movement. I said, there's a problem with this. And it started dawning on me. And then I started looking into it and looking at the towers. And you can see explosive jets coming out of the towers, certainly on the corners and on the sides at times. So it all started to look like this was a setup. And that very possibly that those aircraft impacts were nothing but causal ruses to blame outsiders. So,
did it not cross your mind that perhaps Al-Qaeda could have got in very, very quickly and planted those explosives?
Well, yeah, I guess it did. But the fact of the matter is the authorities in the United States haven't interrogated anybody that had access to the interiors of buildings. I found that out later. I started looking into it. And I said, somebody could have done that. Who did it? I didn't say immediately it was somebody in the United States, but I knew that it wasn't because of the aircraft impacts. Certainly Building 7 wasn't. And Building 7 was a controlled demolition. I watched Silverstein say that. And by the way, when I started to realize that there was something wrong, I contacted the History Channel. Every show for years, they would say, if you want this show on DVD or CD or DVD or VHS, you know, just call this number or go to this website. Well, I called them about that show, and I asked about it, and they told me that series was not available to the public. You know, the show certainly existed. I saw it. I'm not making this up. I have no reason to make it up. I'm a 58-year-old engineer. It doesn't behoove me to do that. So, you know, I looked into it, and it turns out that this is not what we've been told, unfortunately.
Well, of course, we're going to be getting into some of the detail about the 25 points of this white paper that you published, some of the significant points anyway in a few minutes from now. But I think it would be good first to get an idea of this group of engineers that you're part of and the complaint and legal avenues that you and your colleagues are beginning to pursue before we start getting into any technical details of the findings themselves. So could you tell us a little bit more about this group of engineers?
Yeah, the group of engineers, there's some in the UK and some here in the States. Originally, they came to me, as you know, they knew I was a researcher in this. And I was familiar with one fellow here, David Cole. And it turns out there's several fellows over there. Some of them use acronyms to protect themselves, but they were part of the group. And they would have meetings on like Pal Talk. And they did quite a bit. They looked at a lot of different things. They did some videos that showed things weren't right. And one of them, the guy from here in Vermont, happened to notice the drawings were released. I should say the drawings were released in late 2011. And they undertook a review of the drawing above Building 7. Mm-hmm. And we've never gotten the drawings from the towers. All we have is what's in the NIST reports.
Right.
I guess some architectural drawings, but they weren't. They need the structural drawings and details.
So these are Building 7 drawings, but I understand not all of them have been released. Is that right?
Well, it's probably around 80% have mm-hmm. been released. They withheld some. Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. Some shop fabrication or detail drawings. But anyway, when they looked at it, they noticed this one assembly. NIST claims happened in Building 7 is that a girder was pushed off its seat.
Yeah. Can I just stop you there? Because I don't want to get into all the details of this now. I just wanted to ask so that people know who this group of engineers is. Is this group made up of people who are members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth?
Some of them are. Some of them are.
Okay. Now, I understand that in December last year, the well-known lawyer Dr. William Pepper wrote a letter on behalf of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth to the Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Commerce, putting various complaints about NIST's work, especially to do with Building 7, based on the research of this group that you've just been talking about. Now, I know that William Pepper is very well-known over in the States, but in the UK, probably not so much. So could you tell us just a little bit about who William Pepper is and in what capacity he is acting on behalf of Architects and Engineers 9/11 Truth in this?
Right. Yeah, well, William Pepper is best known for representing the Martin Luther King family in a civil suit in Memphis, Tennessee in the 90s. Where they won a judgment against a defendant or somebody they filed suit against that was alleging was part of a conspiracy. And they won the suit. I think it was only $100 that changed hands. It was the point of the matter. And he wrote a book called An Act of State showing that the Martin Luther King assassination was, in fact, a conspiracy. And there was some governmental involvement in it. So that's what he's most well known for. He's basically a human rights attorney. And I think he has a connection to the UK also.
Yeah. And he's representing Architects and Engineers 9/11 Truth in some way. Is that right?
Yeah, he did. He wrote this letter and he's involved with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Yes.
Okay. Now, in the letter, he makes it clear that he believes that the Inspector General, Mr. Todd Zinser, is obliged to open an investigation into what NIST has done with respect to Building 7. And let me just quote from the letter. Mr. Zinser, quite frankly, the credibility of NIST and the Department of Commerce requires that you open an investigation into the potential negligence and or misconduct by the lead investigators of NIST's Building 7 investigation, and that NIST be directed to produce a corrected analysis and report on the collapse of Building 7. So what has been the result of Dr. Pepper's letter? Has the Inspector General agreed to do anything about this?
Well, actually, he remanded it to NIST, whose reports we are challenging and that were being challenged in a letter. He remanded it to them and allowed them to answer. And basically, they said they looked into the assertions in the letter. They don't feel need to change their report, and they stand behind their work. They didn't support their position at all on any of the specific challenges that were in that letter. And there was a technical analysis included with that letter. They did not feel the need to discuss any of it. That's what how they answered in April. However, recently there's ongoing discussion between Dr. Pepper and the Inspector General. And there's some other things happening relative to the licenses of some of these engineers that put those reports out.
So does it look like some kind of legal action is going to take place, do you think?
I think it can. And NIST has a formal process called the Request for Correction. Basically, the Pepper letter was that. But some people are saying we have to follow their formal process. And if they don't, then, you know, there's grounds to go to court for a remedy. Essentially, the way they answered that William Pepper's letter was to say, we're not doing anything. You know, it's a total, it's just a stonewall. You know, any engineer that looks at this, what we're talking about here is they left out pertinent structural features that would have made a difference if they were included. And it's obvious why they left him out. They left stiffeners off that girder that were part of it, and they had no reason to leave him off other than they claimed that the girder got pushed off its seat and that the flange folded up. The stiffeners that were on there would have stopped that from happening. So, you know, in the report, the girder shows up without stiffeners on it. And, you know, like I was saying, one of the things that one of the fellows in this group, they found the stiffeners on the drawings once they were released. And that started the ball rolling.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's turn to some of these technical complaints then against NIST. There are loads of things we could talk about with these 25 points, but I want to start, if we may, with the points that Dr. Pepper stresses in that letter to the Inspector General and that they concentrate particularly on Building 7. So let me just do a quick recap, if I may, on what NIST basically says about Building 7. I'm taking this from Kevin Ryan's words when he gave his presentation at the Toronto hearings in 2011. And I'll just say what he says, and you can add to it or correct if I misquote him. This is what Kevin Ryan said. Quote, thermal expansion of the floor system surrounding column 7 led to the collapse of floor 13, which triggered a cascade of floor failures. In this case, the floor beams on the northeast corner of the building expanded enough that they pushed the girder spanning between columns 79 to 44 to the west on the 13th floor. This movement was enough for the girder to walk off its support at column 79. End quote. Okay, so does that sum it up, would you say?
That's in this claim, right, that Kevin was giving there, right?
Okay, so the points that Dr. Pepper stresses in this letter correspond to points 1 and 2 in the white paper, and I want to ask about point 6 as well. So we'll start with point 1, and here you say in point 1 that NIST has omitted from its considerations what you were just talking about, girder stiffeners, which you know from the technical drawings of Building 7 would have been present in that construction, and they would have prevented NIST's scenario from playing out. So could you explain to us how that works? Why would they have prevented that explanation from being true?
Right. If you look at the stiffeners, they come out, you know, the girder is an I-beam shape, and these stiffeners come out from the web across to the edge of the flange.
Okay, can I just stop you? What's the web and what's the flange?
Oh, the web. A web of a girder or I-beam is the deep vertical part. The flanges are the horizontal plates, top and bottom. But the web is the center vertical portion. And these stiffeners are basically horizontal and vertical pieces that come out at the end of the girder from the web out to the edge, out to the flange at the bottom. There are additional plates that are welded to the web and the flange.
Okay, so am I right in thinking they're actually stiffening the connection between these things? Is that right?
Right. They would stiffen the connection. They would stiffen the flange. They're meant to help to keep the web from what they call crippling or buckling, local buckling, but they would also stiffen the flange. So what this has happened is that the girder actually, it's sitting on its seat, and when it was pushed by beams on one side of it, the web, which handles most of the load, would be pushed past the edge of the seat, and the flange, which is less than an inch thick, can't handle the load that's on that girder, that it would fold upward, bend upward, and fail, and the girder would fall. If the stiffeners are there, they're coming from the web out to the edge of the flange. The flange can take a lot more bending. Instead of just being an inch thick, it has an 18-inch high, 3/4-inch thick stiffener, stiffening it. It wouldn't fail in bending. And they left them off. And it's quite obvious why they left them off, because that flange wouldn't fail. So now, instead of the beams that are pushing the girder can only expand so much. At 600 degrees centigrade, they can only expand 5.5 inches. Well, the seat was 12 inches wide. Originally, they claimed it was only 11, and that was another error we corrected with them. The drawing showed it was 12 inches wide. But at any rate, the beams can only push the girder so far. With those stiffeners on there, you'd have to push it about 10 inches. They can't get that much push. So they, in the report, you don't see where they show that girder. You don't see the stiffeners, but they're on the drawings. And the drawings came out several years after the report. And they haven't responded to this. They're saying our analysis showed that the stiffeners weren't needed. Really? You know, and why would you even do an analysis to show that?
So when you actually go to the NIST's report on Building 7, you actually see a drawing of this without the stiffeners in place.
That's exactly right. There's a technical analysis, 11-page technical analysis that went along with the Pepper letter. It shows what the drawing actually showed and shows what the NIST report figure showed. And you'll see it without the stiffeners in the report.
Mm-hmm. And you say that if the stiffeners were in place, as you say they were in fact in place, that there's no way enough energy could have been produced to actually get past that stiffener and cause the accident to take place.
No. In fact, anybody that's done an analysis, which I have and others have, you can't get enough stress. The deeper something is, the stiffener allows it to take a lot more load without overstressing it. It could take somewhere around 5 times the load that was on it with the stiffeners on there. Without the stiffeners, it would have been up and folded, sure. But you're talking about a 7/8 inch thick flange unstiffened that could bend up versus a 7/8 thick flange with an 18-inch high, 3/4 inch thick stiffener across it. You know, they can take a lot more bending. You know, it's sort of like if you took a diving board, per se, you know, you can see how when it's horizontal, it's springy. If you turn the diving board 90 degrees, now try to make it flex. It's a lot harder because the resistance to bending is a function of the depth cubed. We call it moment of inertia. You can see when I put that 18-inch high stiffener on there, it's going to stiffen that 7/8 thick flange quite a bit, and it does. And they left them off for obvious because they couldn't get the flange to fail. And then when they're called on it, they don't want to answer. So that's what's going on. They're sort of caught.
Am I right in thinking that they haven't released the drawing, which is most obviously shows that part of the building, but that you've got evidence of it from other drawings?
That's right. They didn't release what's called the shop drawing for that girder, which is the fabrication drawing or the detail drawing. However, those stiffeners are shown and detailed on an assembly of that girder and the seat for it at column 79. And they're detailed. The stiffeners are detailed, and so is the seat. They also claim the seat, even though they can only get 5.5 inches of push from these beams to the east of that girder. And interestingly, in their report, they said the seat was only 11 inches wide. But then it turns out when the drawings came out, the seat is 12 inches wide. So they did address that, and they said, all right, it was a mistake on their part. The seat is actually 12 inches wide, and they said they need 6.25 inches of lateral push, even though they don't say how they'll get that.
So before they needed 5.5 inches, is that right, of lateral push?
Right. And
okay, so now they need an extra bit, and there's no way, they're not actually explaining how they get it at all.
That's right.
Would it be possible to get that if you heated the beam sufficiently, that they would expand that much?
No, what's interesting is just above 600 degrees, what happens is, with the load on it, the beams start to sag, and you get a sort of competition between how much it expands and how much it shortens due to sagging.
Uh-huh.
And when you do that, and a number of us have done those calculations, you get more sagging and shortening than you do expansion. So there's a limit. It's somewhere around 639 degrees C, where it actually shortens more for every degree increase in heat. It shortens more than it expands.
Okay. And do you know actually where that point of diminished returns actually occurs? I mean, how long does it get before you start losing it?
I think it's somewhere around 5.6, 5.7 inches, and that's it.
Wow.
So.
And yet they've said that it did in fact reach 6.25, and they've not justified that at all.
No, they haven't. And that's without the stiffeners. They need 6.25. When you put the stiffeners on, now you need like 10 inches.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The 6.25 is just because of the seat actually being 12 inches wide, where they said it was 11, to sort of match. It seems like to match their 5.5 max or so. And then when they were called on the 12-inch wide seat, they said 6.25 without justifying where they would get that from. And like I said, there's diminishing returns. You can't get anywhere. You can't even get near 6.
Yeah. But they've admitted this one error, but they've replaced it with another error, in a sense.
That's right. They admitted to the seat width. And they've admitted to leaving the stiffeners off now. And there's another one, the beam closest to the north face in that corner. There's lateral support beams that are missing in their analysis, too.
Yeah, this is point number 2, isn't it, in the 25 points here?
Right.
So this is the 3 support beams on the 13th floor beam, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so they've got 3 missing beams. What difference does that make?
Well, they're saying that beam buckled when it was expanded against the girder because the girder couldn't move because it was locked into between the flanges of the exterior column. But they took the beams off, and what happens is those 3 beams coming from the exterior into this 52-foot-long beam. Well, when the three support beams are there, it's much harder to buckle that beam. In buckling, it's a function of the length squared. The slenderness is a function of the length squared.
Could you explain what slenderness means in this context?
Right. If everybody can imagine, sort of, if you have a long, skinny pole, it's easy to push on it and have it bend, you know, horizontally. And that's slenderness. The thinner it is, and the less supported it is, and the longer it is, it's easier to make it bend and buckle. If we can imagine something going up the side of a house that's unsupported, say 25 foot tall, you know, maybe a 1-inch diameter or 2-inch diameter rod, you can see it'd be somewhat slender. Now, if I bring supports off the side of the house at prescribed equal distances, three of them, you can see it'd be a lot harder to buckle that.
Yes. Okay. So, and you describe that as a reduction in slenderness.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it's a function of length squared. So if I have it broken up into quarters, it's actually 16 times less slender than it is without those support beams.
Wow.
It wouldn't buckle. It would have just deflected the girder. And the analysis shows that. And they left them off too.
So the drawings actually show those three beams there. But when you actually turn to the NIST report on Building 7, they're not there.
In their analysis, it's not there. And the figures they show in their analysis, not there. And they've admitted to this in a letter to a senator that was due to a constituent. They've admitted to both the stiffeners on that girder being omitted and these three lateral support beams. They've admitted to that. And they're saying, well, they're not needed, though. That's what they say.
All right. So we have a catalog here of errors or mistakes. We'll see what we make of that in a minute. There's also point six that I wanted to ask you about. This is in the white paper that your colleague suggested was very important. And this concerns something that Kevin Ryan mentioned on this program, actually, in our last interview with him. I think it might be good to go over it again very briefly. This has to do with the use of composite beams and shear studs in Building 7 and how NIST seemed to change its mind as to whether those were there or not. Could you explain what these composite beams and shear studs are?
Yeah, basically everybody can imagine you have girders and beams that your flooring goes on, the concrete deck. And what they do is make the concrete deck composite with the girder or beam by using studs that are welded onto the top of the girder or beam. And it makes it like a T beam with the concrete acting with the beam because of the shear studs that are trapped in the concrete, but they're welded to the beam. So it works together, and that gives you a greater stiffness. NIST said in their draft report of 2004 or 5 on Building 7 that there was no shear studs on the girders in the core, okay? And then later on, they said, when they came up with this other explanation in their final report, they said there was no shear studs on any girders. Well, this girder that they say fell down 8 floors or that walked off its seat, if it would have had shear studs, you couldn't push it off its seat because these shear studs go from the top of the girder into the concrete floor. The floor is 5 inches thick. The beams pushing on it would have buckled before you could push that girder anywhere with it having studs going into the floor. So before they came out their final report, or when they did, they said there was no studs, shear studs on that girder, even though earlier they only restricted that statement to girders in the core. Well, this girder is not in the core. It goes from the core to the exterior. So they changed what they were saying there. And it's funny because on other drawings of that same girder on different floors in the building, it shows shear studs. Additionally, there's a fellow that was the project manager for Frankel Steel. They were the supplier of the steel and the erector of the building. In the 80s, he wrote a paper about Building 7. It's quite a large building, like I was saying. In fact, it's 3/4 the volume of the Empire State Building. So people get a feel for how big this building was volume-wise. In his paper, he shows 33 shear studs on that girder. Now, he's talking about all the floors. And they're saying that there's no reference. This was asked about that. They said there's no reference to any single floor in his papers. The fellow's name is John Salvarinas. So there's a lot of controversy over that. But even if they didn't have shear studs, I'll give them that. If those stiffeners are on that girder, they can't push it off. And the alternative was that beam buckling in the north. And if the lateral support beams are on that, that can't buckle. So they don't have a way to get that girder off of that seat and for 8 floors to collapse, to initiate the collapse like they say. It doesn't work if these omitted features are included in their analysis.
And is it right that there would be some drawing showing the shear studs, but they've just not released that yet?
That's possible. But in my mind, the shear studs are less of an issue because there's other things that make them moot. And that's the stiffeners and the lateral support beams.
Yeah.
It just shows you that they did have a change there. But the fact that the seat is 12 inches wide, they left the stiffeners off and they left those lateral support beams off. You can give them the shear studs. It becomes a moot point. It's overcome by other things we learned that they left off that are greater, and they can't get there when those things are included. So fine, they can say that the shear studs were left off. That's not going to get them there.
But whatever, we have yet another, well, I'm going to put this in inverted commas, mistake that seems to all be in one direction, pointing towards the conclusion that they want to present.
That's right. That's right. There's lots of mistakes that go in the direction that they want to present. Yeah, they're all in that direction.
Oh, it's certainly very, very, very suspicious indeed.
Sure.
Yeah. So another couple of points here to do with this white paper. So this is points 3 and 4. So point 3 is to do with the free fall and the possibility of the use of explosives. And point 3, you say that NIST acknowledges that Building 7 did fall at true free fall speed for 2.25 seconds, a distance of about 100 feet. But that even though NIST acknowledges this, although I understand they didn't acknowledge it for quite a long time until I think it was David Chandler challenged them a few years ago. But even though they now acknowledge this free fall for this 2.25 seconds in their report, they don't address the implications of this fact. So could you spell out what those implications are?
Sure. You know, Shyam Sunder, the lead investigator for NIST, said it himself in a press conference. He said, you know, a structure in free fall is a structure with no resistance below it. So to be in free fall, at free fall acceleration, the upper section of the building is falling, can't be doing any work. It can't be buckling or crushing or deforming anything below it. Because in free fall, to get to free fall, all of the potential energy needs to be being converted to kinetic energy. The moment it starts doing any other work, doing any of those other things, deforming or buckling, crushing, it has to slow down. So the fact that this building, this upper section of the building, the roofline falls at true full free fall acceleration for over 100 feet, symmetrically, the entire upper section of the building. It's not doing any work, so there's no resistance. There's no structure beneath it for those 8 stories. And to admit that it's in free fall, but not address the implications is disingenuous in the least. And that's what they've done. They had to admit to it because you can measure it. And Chandler said that. He said that to him. It's a publicly verifiable item. How do you not admit to that? And so they did admit it, but they didn't address it.
And you say that because of this, they should really have looked into the question of explosives, because that's the most obvious cause of such a phenomenon. But they didn't.
No, they didn't. In fact, they say that none of the steel was saved from Building 7. If they're claiming that this is the first building, high-rise, steel-framed high-rise building in history to have collapsed due to fire, that's what their claim is. Yet none of the steel was saved. That's incredible. I don't know another word that can describe that. I mean, it's just extraordinary. The whole thing begs of disingenuousness and is highly suspicious. And then when we find out later, 3 years after the report, when the drawings are released, that they left off pertinent structural features, I think it ices the cake that there's a serious problem and there needs to be an investigation of what was going on when this did these reports.
Now, I understand that they should have looked for explosives according to a particular protocol. This is the National Fire Protection Standard, NFPA 921. This is a guide for fire and explosion investigations. Does that actually say that that's what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, well, it says that you're supposed to do that in the case of high order damage, which there was, and complete collapse, that type of thing. And you're supposed to, they also say if you don't save the steel or test for accelerants or explosives, you need to be prepared to explain why you haven't. They haven't explained that.
This is very interesting because actually I did listen to an interview conducted by Alan Reese of No Lies Radio with Dr. S. Shyam Sunder. I think this is just hot on the heels of the actual release in 2008 of the Building 7 report itself. And he asked Dr. Sunder, you know, why did you not test for explosives? And Dr. Sunder said something like, well, we thought that wasn't a very feasible hypothesis, and that's why we didn't look for it. I mean, I thought that was quite incredible. I mean, how did you react to that information? question.
Yeah, well, what would give him a reason not to or to believe that it wasn't a probable hypothesis? You know, when something's coming down with no structural resistance under it, you have to think that some kind of device removed the structural integrity. What could that be? Mostly those type of things are explosives, and that there were witnesses that heard explosions. So he's being disingenuous there.
I might actually insert that little bit of audio there, because it's quite a remarkable thing that he says there. He just says, you know, that we looked at these things and we decided that that wasn't an avenue that we were going to look at because it didn't seem to fit with what we thought was credible.
Well, it may well have been an avenue that he was told not to look at. So I'm not going to put it all on Dr. Sunder, other than the fact that, you know, there's people above him that may have told him not to look there. I don't know. All I know is they should have looked there. Everything points to the fact that any legitimate investigation would have, in fact, looked there, especially with the symmetric freefall of the building. That can only happen one way.
Yeah.
And he even admitted that. He said there's no structural resistance under a structure in freefall. So he's sort of contradicting himself.
Yeah. It sounds like he's in a very difficult position himself, actually.
He may well be. That's right.
Last year, physicist Stephen Jones and two other physicists and a geologist analyzed the slag at the end of the beams, and they found iron, aluminum, sulfur, manganese, and fluorine, the chemical evidence for thermate, a high-tech incendiary cutting charge used by the military. The byproduct of thermite is molten iron. Now, did you, in your investigation, did you interview these physicists or examine their evidence and findings?
No, we did not.
Why not?
And for a very simple reason. We looked at all of the alternative hypotheses that were being presented. We looked at we considered all of the possible hypotheses, and then we made a technical judgment in terms of what would actually be a credible hypothesis. And among the credible hypotheses we identified were the diesel fuel that was stored to power up the emergency generators in the building, the transfer elements, transfer trusses, girders, and overhangs that were in the building because the office building was built on top of an electric substation. And third, we wanted to look at hypothetical blast events because there was some suggestion, though we had not seen any evidence of it, that the manner in which Tower 7, Building 7, seemed to collapse was similar in some features to a controlled demolition. Beyond that, we looked at clearly the information about alternative theories beyond these three or four that I just mentioned and did not feel that any of them were credible enough in our technical judgment.
Okay, now, National Fire Protection Association, NFPA 921 Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, dictates in a fire investigation that certain residues be tested for. Shouldn't you have tested those residues that Stephen Jones has found, according to your own dictates?
No. As I said before, the process we followed was very systematic. We looked at possible hypotheses. We decided technically what would muster to be a credible hypothesis. And then we proceeded to investigate those credible hypotheses more in detail. The hypothesis that we deemed not to be credible, we decided were hypotheses that needed way more information to be even feasible. They are not even feasible. Just because thermite or thermate exists in some dust particles does not necessarily translate into thermite being the cause of the building failure. There's no theory around it. There's just observations, isolated observations.
There was this business about Dr. John Gross, wasn't there?
Right.
And in the 25 points paper, you have a picture of him there actually standing next to and even holding, I think, a piece of steel that's clearly been subject to very, very high temperatures. And yet, when he was asked in some sort of public situation, he was asked, you know, was there any molten steel? And he denied it, didn't he? He said, oh, no, there's no testimony to that or something along those lines. Did you want to explain what happened with that?
Yeah, well, he's standing right next to a beam that obviously experience some level of melting, temperatures that could cause melting. That's the only way those holes can get in that web of that beam. And then he's saying he knows of nobody, or he hasn't seen it, who's talked about molten metal. Well, he has a photo taken with something that had to have experienced melting. He's being disingenuous. Again, this, the whole thing is disingenuous.
That is an incredible one. I can see why you included that in the report.
Yeah.
It's very striking.
Yeah, we didn't know for a long time that he was there. It wasn't until the reports came out that he was in the yards early on. And he admits that on video, that he was in the yards. Well, yeah, he's holding on to a beam that had to have experienced melting. There's no other way to get those holes that I know of.
I'm curious about the pool of molten steel that was found in the bottom of the towers.
I am too.
And
please tell me about it. Have you seen it?
Well, not personally, but eyewitnesses there found huge poles of molten steel beneath the towers, and some scientists don't think that the collapse of the building could have melted all that steel. And physics professor analyzed some of the steel, and Stephen Jones, and he found evidence of thermate residue, which would explain how the buildings collapsed by means of pre-planted explosives. So have you analyzed the steel for any of those residues?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it. I was on the site, I was on the steel yards, so I don't know that that's so.
There's video of it.
Melted around 2,600 degrees Fahrenheit. I think it's probably pretty difficult to get that kind of temperatures in a fire. So I don't know the basis. I can't address your question if I don't know the basis.
Well, NASA pictures, thermal images showed those sorts of temperatures in the basement.
Could you send them to me?
Okay.
John, let me break in. There's clearly an opposing viewpoint here, but I prefer that not to dominate. For those of you interested,
there's a sheet of questions here that they're asking if you want to see them.
I believe you all have a presentation that's tomorrow or Thursday, so I'd invite anyone who's interested to go there. So certainly want to respect those opposing viewpoints, but I prefer not to get into a major debate on those issues.
Questioning.
Well, isn't that what this is about?
What are questions for? What are questions for? Aren't we supposed to question things? Okay, one more question.
I mean, another very serious observation, it's connected to what you were just saying about the way this building just came down in this very symmetrical kind of way, is this observation that when we look at the video footage, we don't see any, well, not much anyway, you don't see much sort of distortion as it's coming down, and yet the computer modeling by NIST actually produces these images which show really quite considerable distortion. So doesn't that in itself kind of disprove, you know, what NIST is saying here?
Of course. They didn't replicate the failure, is what it says. They try to say that one column, because of the girder falling off its seat and the floors collapsing, that one column is left unsupported laterally. The column could take so many floors being unsupported, but it couldn't go continuous. And so when it was unsupported for 8 or 9 stories, they say it buckled, caused the east side interior to complete its east side interior to collapse, and then it had a progression from east to west. And then that the exterior collapsed under its own weight because it was no longer supported laterally. The problem with that is the east side exterior doesn't deform in the real building when they're saying the whole east side interior came down. In their model, it does, as it should, okay? Because columns can only go so far with lateral support. They can't go 47 stories. They would fall under their own weight. If you support them laterally, you're keeping them from bending, bowing out, and buckling. And you don't need a lot of support. It's only like 0.6% each floor. But the point is, once they get slender like that, if the whole interior came down on the east side exterior would, in fact, deform inward. And you see that in their model, where they're saying this happened, and they show the east side interior coming down. In the real world, in the real video, that doesn't happen. The exterior is not deforming inward like it is in their model. So their model didn't replicate the real failure. And you know, I can tell you what I think happened, and it's not hard to say. If you took out the 24 core columns, they would pull the exterior inward, causing them to buckle. if you took out 8 stories of the core, the 24 core columns, they would pull the exterior inward, and it would all come down all at once, and you would replicate what you see in video.
Okay.
They didn't do that.
Presumably because of that would have presented them with a kind of demolition situation again.
That's exactly right. You got it. I think you had to take out 8 stories of the central core, which is the 24 interior core columns. I think that's what happened.
And you had to do that, would you say, simultaneously rather than some sort of progressive collapse?
Well, it's almost simultaneous. The way they do this, in order to keep a building like that in its own footprint, which Building 7 certainly did to a large degree, and that's all they're ever shooting for in a controlled demolition, you take out the very center of the core. A split second, it progresses from the center out, and that keeps everything pulled in. And this happens in less than a second. 8 stories of that core would have been taken out in less than a second. You could have had a quarter or half second between the very center core columns and the outer core columns.
Okay. Well, there are other technical problems I also like to ask you about to do with the twin towers, because your white paper covers, well, there are 11 points actually to do with that as well. So I just want to ask you about a couple of them. Point 20 asks, and I'm going to go for point 18 first, actually. This echoes something that Kevin Ryan mentioned again in our interview with him. Now, you say that NIST introduced this artificial force. Now, Kevin Ryan calls it an imaginary force, and this is a 5,000 pounds of imaginary force to each perimeter column because their computer models weren't giving them the results that they were looking for. Now, is it as bald as that? They were just adding something to make it work.
Yeah, they actually did that, and they said they had pictures of the columns being inwardly bowed on the south face of the North Tower 22 minutes before collapse. There's no video that I know of that shows that. So when they did their model, their finite element model, and they sagged the trusses on the interior, they did not pull the exterior columns inward. So they said because they had this picture showing it, that they're claiming occurred 22 minutes before, they said, well, we're going to put this load on there that we think happened somehow, but they don't have any evidence of it, to cause that inward bowing. And that's what they did. So
they just needed it, so they plucked it out of the air.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's a circular argument. And the fact that they are claiming that those pictures were taken, that picture or photo was taken 22 minutes before, is also suspicious. Because the Twin Towers wouldn't take it down the same way as Building 7. You pull the core, and that pulls the exterior inward. So the exterior columns were certainly pulled inward, but it was when the collapse occurred. So they're trying to say it was 22 minutes before, and that's what caused the collapse. But there's problems with that, too, because just having that one wall fail is not going to cause enough of a load on the orthogonal walls on the east and west of the tower and the core. Only 20% of the capacity of those exterior columns being used. So if you lost the south exterior wall, there's not enough load there to cause the east and west walls to collapse or the core. So it's sort of just a NIST only goes up to the point where they say the tower is poised to collapse, but they don't prove. They just make a claim that this whole section was failing as though that would cause additional failure. Well, you had the whole north face, 60% of the columns on the north face were broken when the aircraft impacted the building. The wall didn't fail. It redistributed the load of those missing columns through the beams, the spandrel beams on every floor, to the remaining columns on that face. In addition to that, the chief engineer, John Skilling, of Skillington Helen Worthington, the firm that designed the Twin Towers. In 1993, he was asked about it when the bombing occurred in the basement. And, of course, that was a 1,200-pound truck bomb, and that didn't take down the building. Made a big hole in the basement, 36-foot diameter hole, several floors, but it didn't take the building down. And he said then that the building, you could lose a full face and the corners and 50% of the columns on the two sides, and the building would still be able to take 100-mile-per-hour wind. Okay, he also said that there was a white paper done about aircraft impact and that it could take a 600-mile-per-hour 707, which is the largest plane at the time in the 60s, it'd take an impact from that, and you know there'd be a horrendous fire from the fuel, but the building, the structure would still be there. And they did that analysis in the 60s, and it could probably take multiple impacts. So the NIST analysis is it's not legitimate. Unfortunately, it doesn't go to the point where it shows you why the rest of the building would fail or why the collapse would propagate horizontally, which is the next point you wanted to discuss.
Well, absolutely. Yes, indeed. This is a rather difficult one to ask. But I mean, the bit that I really connected with was when you said about how these buildings came down in a sort of disintegration phenomenon. And we see the upper section of each building disintegrating as it comes down. And the implications of this seems to be that the mass was not available then to serve as a pile driver, which is what people seem to talk about so much, you know, that it crushed the lower part of the building. Can you explain how that works then?
Yeah, if you watch video closely, what happens, the North Tower, which is easier to analyze because it doesn't tilt like the South Tower did. The South Tower section tilted 23 degrees. The North Tower doesn't. Actually, the upper 12 stories, it initiates at the 98th floor. And that initiation occurs in actually less than a second across the entire 98th floor. And it comes down very evenly for the first couple, two, three stories. Now, how you get that even an initiation is it can only happen one way. And I think there was a firefighter in the New York Fire Department. The man was killed, but he had been asked, and he said that it was just too even. He thought there were explosives in it, just from that perspective. And I certainly do for that reason, right, too.
So what you're saying, that it should really, according to their sort of version of things, it should have failed at one corner or something like that?
It should have failed south to north, mm-hmm, in a progressive way. It didn't. Mm. You know, it failed very rapidly across one full floor, the 98th floor. And then you're talking about this disintegration. What really happens, the 97, or the next floor down, doesn't fail. The floor above fails. And then the floor above that and above that. About at least two, if not three floors above it fail. So you have the 98th fail, and then the 99th, 100th, 101st seem to disintegrate and just, you know, lose all structural integrity before anything happens below. Hmm. What that appears to be, and this is speculation on my part, but I think it's informed speculation. If there were charges in that building, and there was an aircraft impact, the aircraft impacted it. Also, interestingly, the 98th floor was above the aircraft impact, just above it. The aircraft impacted between the 95th and 96th floors at a 10-degree downward angle. So the collapse didn't even occur where the aircraft impact damage was. There was essentially no aircraft impact damage on the 98th floor. It got hit by about 5 foot of wingtip because the plane was rolled 30 degrees. And that's it. And this didn't even see fit to show any damage on the 98th floor in their models. So in their figures in their report, because there was not, essentially. But that's where it initiated. So that makes you wonder, why did it initiate at the 98th floor? Same thing happens with the South Tower. It initiates at the 82nd floor. The aircraft hit somewhere around the 79th and 80th. So,
And you can see this on the video, can you?
Yes, you can see it. You have to know where the 98th floor is. But that's, NIST admits it initiated in the North Tower and the 98th floor. And again, we look at the North Tower much more because it doesn't have that extreme tilt. So it initiates on the 98th floor, which is above the aircraft impact damage. The horizontal propagation occurs in somewhere around 7 to 8 tenths of a second. Now, people have to remember, these buildings were 207 feet, or a little over 63 meters on a side. That's just under 300 feet corner to corner. The southwest corner and the northeast corner, which are diagonally 300 feet from each other, or just under that, come down in within a second of each other. So this is very rapid horizontal propagation. It's clear that it's not due to a progressive failure from one side of the building to the other. It's clear that this was happening due to some kind of demolition devices on that floor. You know, I mean, I don't know how else you get that to happen. A progressive collapse cannot happen that quickly or evenly across an entire floor of something that large, that wide. It just doesn't work like that.
And the NIST report doesn't address that. It only goes up to that point. Is that right?
It only goes up to the point where they say that south wall buckled because of the inward bowing. Mm-hmm. And they stop there. And then they depend on this professor from Northwestern University. His name is Professor Zednik Bazant. Mm-hmm. But he talks about why it propagated vertically. Neither one of them talk about how the horizontal propagation occurred. They skip over that.
And he came up with explanations, is it within about 2 days of the events?
Yeah, he wrote a paper to the American Society of Civil Engineers journal called the Journal of Engineering Mechanics. He says that there would have been a powerful jolt, and that's a dynamic load. And it's true that you can have a natural collapse, even though the structure underneath is built to handle several times the load above it. You can have it when you get an impact. The reason for that is you have an amplified load. The static load is equal to mass times gravity. Everybody's familiar with that. That's what we call weight. But this amplification and an impact, and most people are familiar with, you're aware that when you have an impact or when you drop something on the floor, it breaks, where if you just set it on the floor or on a table, it wouldn't break. So there's a greater load. And the way that's caused is you also, in addition to the mass times gravity static load, in an impact, you have the mass times the deceleration of the impacting object, and that causes an amplified load on the object it's impacting. For instance, when you hit a nail with a hammer, if you just held a nail against a piece of wood with your thumb and your finger or index finger, and you just laid the hammer head on top of the nail, you can imagine it's not going to drive the nail into the wood, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now if you swing the hammer against the head of the nail, you can realize it's going to drive it. Well, what's driving it is you're getting this amplification that's greater than the static load of the hammerhead. But what happens? The hammerhead decelerates, and that's that amplified portion that I just mentioned, the mass times the deceleration. It's actually accelerating the impacted object, where in that case, it'd be accelerating the nail into the wood. But the key thing here is that the impacting object, which would be the upper section of the building in this case, has to decelerate. Well, it turns out when you measure it, and this didn't happen for several years at 2001, we measured it. A number of people did, including Graham McQueen and David Chandler. They were two of the ones that did, and others too. There's no deceleration. So this powerful jolt that Dr. Bazant theorized didn't exist, and he didn't know that. And he had to admit that it didn't decelerate. And interestingly, in 2010, he wrote a paper saying why the motion history was smooth, why you don't see the deceleration. And he wrote that and published it in the Journal of Engineering Mechanics again. And he said it was only 3% deceleration, you wouldn't see it. Well, another Canadian professor and I, a professor named Richard Johns from the University of British Columbia, who, by the way, he's a philosopher of science, but he has a bachelor's degree in engineering, an undergraduate degree from I think it's University of Nottingham mm-hmm. in the UK. Him and I wrote a discussion paper critiquing what Bazant said. He wrote that with one of his graduate students, Jia Liang Lei. It turned out that they were claiming figures for the strength of the columns that were way under what they actually were, even though they weren't saying that. They were just giving values that were way under the actual columns. In addition, he used free fall through the first story, and that wasn't true when you measure it. It's about 2/3 of free fall. Well, that makes a big difference for kinetic energy, where the energy is a function of velocity squared. It actually fell through the first 12 feet or so. It would have been moving at 6.3 or 6.1 meters per second, I think. When you square that, that's like a little over 36. In free fall, it would have been moving at 8.5 meters per second velocity after the first 12 feet, and that gives you somewhere around 72 or so. It's like double. So he's doubling the kinetic energy velocity component. He uses the maximum design load mass, which wasn't what the buildings were actually carrying. That's like the maximum load for your car you use. Say it failed with only you in the driver's seat, nothing else in the car. And then you use the absolute max design load, as if it had five adults in it and the trunk was full. Well, that's not true. That's what he does. So he increases the mass that way to get much more kinetic energy. Then he uses a column strength, what they call the plastic moment value, which is the amount of energy to bend the column, that's at least half of what it actually was. And we showed that in our, what they call a discussion paper, critiquing the paper they published of Bazant's. They refused to publish it without showing we were wrong. And this went on over 27 months. So the American Society for Civil Engineering journals are withholding information from the public, just like this, unfortunately.
So Bazant is actually arguing there for this pile-driving phenomenon.
Yeah, that's what he's arguing, right? But there's no deceleration,
sure,
right?
Sure. So actually, this makes Chris Moore's point in the debate with Richard Gage sort of irrelevant then. Where, you know, he was saying that, you know, as this pile driver was coming down, even though it was disintegrating, it was still a mass, and so you can't think that it was compromised by being shattered at all. And Richard Gage was saying, yeah, but would you rather have a box of apples fall on your head or a box of, you know, liberated apples falling on your head?
Yeah, no. Chris Moore was saying the mass is still there.
That's right.
But it's like what we call a quasi-static load at that point, Julian. It's not capable of applying an amplified load. It'd be like your hammerhead being a load of marbles. Now try to drive the nail with your load of marbles.
Right.
You see my point? If it's solid, it'll deliver. If it's not solid, if everything's not held together. Now, if you took all those marbles and bonded them together with some kind of strong glue, you could use it like a hammer. But if it's not, if it's all loose stuff, it won't hit with the same import.
Sure.
Okay. So Chris Moore is not right there. Now, at some point, that load of rubble can collapse it once it's enough to fail it statically or quasi-statically. But it can't deliver a dynamic load. And you'd need about 10 floors of that. Those floors, just the floors, the slabs, that was a pretty robust structure. Okay, they had these double 32-inch deep trusses every 80 inches, every 2 meters, just under 80 inches. Every 2 meters, they had double 32-inch deep trusses going from the core to the exterior, and then they had bridging trusses, 4 of them. And if you look at them, you do an analysis on it, and that's also had a 4-inch slab up top, which was composite with those trusses. It was a very robust system. In my analysis and with other engineers, when you heated those trusses to 700 degrees C with the composite floor on it, it only sagged about 2 inches. This wanted to claim 40 inches of sagging. And to do that, they buckled the diagonals in the truss, which was going to be very hard to do. But that's what they did.
So there's yet another case of them doing what fits what they want to achieve rather than what the evidence would actually suggest.
That's right.
So I want to ask you sort of more generally then, looking at this white paper as a whole with its 25 points, and no doubt there are more things that could be said, but you have 25 there in the paper, particularly considering the very striking points that Dr. Pepper addressed in that letter to the Inspector General. Are you clear now that we have a situation where this is a moment of proof that NIST, or a group of people within NIST, was either grossly negligent or fraudulent in their work? Do you think we're at the position now where we can say that there's proof of one or the other of those?
Yeah, I do. Unfortunately, I do believe that. I'm not willing to cast judgment in the sense of without some proper process, but I can say that report is fraudulent and it was done intentionally to make the case that was asked for somehow. Because it's not what happened.
You're prepared to say that it's fraudulent, that it couldn't possibly be just negligence.
No, it wasn't negligence. They admitted they left those parts out intentionally, and that couldn't be due to negligence. They intentionally left out the stiffeners and lateral support beams, and I think made the seat 11 inches wide, even though the drawing showed they were 12. It was 12. Mm-hmm. I think that was intentional. I'm telling the truth. I mean, I believe it was intentional, yes. I think.
That's a difference there. So you think it's intentional, but they haven't actually admitted to it being intentional?
Well, they've admitted to intentionally leaving them out. As far as leaving them out to help make their case, that's a motive type thing. They did intentionally leave them out. The seat width, they say, was a mistake. But leaving out the stiffeners and lateral support beams was intentional. They say they did it because they weren't needed. So they're not admitting to fraud. They're admitting to, in the case of the seat width, they're saying that was an error. Okay, we'll make it, we'll change it. But now we need more lateral travel, even though they don't say how they get that. And then in the case of the omitted structural features, they say, well, they weren't needed. Well, you're not allowed to remove structural features from an analysis that would affect the results. And they certainly do without stating so up front. They don't state that in the report. And don't forget, these were found 3 years after the report was issued. Mm. And they didn't admit to them for 2 years also. They were asked about this in March of 2012. They've only admitted to it. They admitted to the stiffeners in October 2013, 19 months later, and then the support beams in July of this year. So they haven't admitted to leaving these things out for 19 months and then essentially 27 months.
I mean, can you think of any reason why they would want to intentionally leave things out of their report other than they were being breathed on in some way politically?
That's the only thing I can think of, because there's no benign explanation. There's no reason to leave these things out. You're not supposed to. The propensity is to put things in. If you do a structural analysis and leave things out that would affect the results, that's an improper report. That's inappropriate. You know, and they certainly affected their results. So it can only be that they were left out because they wouldn't get the results they were asked to get. That's the only reasonable explanation for it.
So how important a juncture do you think this is for 9/11 truth with this information that you presented to me today?
Well, I don't use the term 9/11 truth. I don't even like to use that in terms of a movement. That's nothing against you.
Yeah.
I'm an engineer. These people are wrong, and a lot of us have signed this AE 9/11 truth petition, if you will, asking for a new investigation. And this shows in black and white that it's needed. And all we're getting is Stonewall, which is nonsense. You know, there's going to be a remedy at some point. You know, this is becoming political instead of doing the right thing. That's what's going on. And, you know, you're not hearing about it in the press, and you should be, other than, you know, shows like yours. You're not hearing in the mainstream media. This is a big thing. If that building came down in another way, people should know about it, and the whole thing should be questioned, what happened on 9/11, because it was used to justify wars. And if the wrong people were blamed and attacked, that has a lot of import. We owe a lot of big apologies around the world. And, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be corrected if that's true. Mm. And it certainly appears that way.
I mean, one of the things which William Pepper made clear in the letter was that, you know, the intention is not to, you know, discredit NIST. That's not what it's about. And he gave every opportunity there. Make sure that NIST can sort this out. We don't have to, you know, go wildly public with this if indeed NIST can make the corrections that are necessary. But as you say, their reaction has not been to go along that route. And he said in the letter that maybe it would be necessary to introduce some kind of legal action. He does mention that. And you said earlier in the interview that you think it's possible things might go in that direction. So do you think that the most likely thing is to go for NIST as a whole, or indeed individuals?
Well, I think it's going to be approached both ways. Certain individuals would have been responsible for certain sections that are clearly incorrect. You know, if there's something I have wrong, say, you know, a report or something, and it's incorrect, and I don't know it's incorrect, and you bring it to my attention, up to that point, it's still a mistake. If I correct it, then there's no problem. If I refuse to correct it and state that it's correct, even though it's clearly incorrect, based on all forms of logic that we recognize, or say it's mathematical, and I don't correct it, at that point, it's no longer a mistake. It's intentional. So we have approached them and asked them. We've shown them we call them errors. They're things that were omitted. We didn't say it was intentional. And they refused to correct it. They refused to recognize that there was any error. And it's clear that there are errors. It's clear that if those features, those omitted features, were included, that their failure hypothesis will not work. And it's not even close. It's not even close.
So one way or another, the truth has to come out about this, except the only thing I'm considering here is, you know, if indeed there is this fraud that's taken place, there are going to be a lot of people in high places who do not want this to be found out about. And therefore, you know, what chance do you think there is that any legal action you take is going to be compromised by these very same people?
Well, now it becomes a corruption, a political thing, and only corrupt influence can stop it.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, we're not naive. We're aware that that can happen. Mm. But the actual things on paper, or the building itself, could not fail the way they're saying. Whether that comes out in the public and in court is another story, because then it's a political issue that they've made it into by not admitting to the reality, the structural reality. Mm. So, I think that's what's going to happen, in the sense that it's going to go to court at some point, or there'll be some remedy, there'll be some action against individuals in some way, shape, or form. We'll see. You know, everybody's not dishonest. However, the courts, there's a good bit of concern, you know, because of high power political people not wanting this out, that they'll try to shut it down.
So on that score, I suppose the most important thing is for as many people across the globe, and particularly, of course, in the US, to know about this. And so to bring kind of media and social pressure to bear upon this.
Right. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm appearing on your show, to let people know that things were left out of those reports. The structural features were left out of their analyses in those reports that would have made their failure hypotheses impossible.
So if that's the case, then as many people need to know about this as possible, then what practical steps would you say that each of us can take to ensure that as many people as possible do in fact get to know about this?
Well, I mean, you can notify your political representatives that there needs to be a new investigation. I think you can do that as much as you can. The problem is a lot of separate individuals and citizens, unless they're united in a large group, are going to have a hard time. You know, they can still ignore a lot of individuals. You know, in high political places, that has happened. We've had proof of these kind of things in the past, and nothing's happened. Yeah. I think, you know, I said there earlier before we went on the air that once I learned that 9/11 wasn't the way these buildings came down, wasn't the way we've been told, and that the aircraft impacts couldn't have done that to the towers, and certainly Building 7 was hit by plane, and it's clearly a controlled demolition, even though NIST tries to say it's fire. They're clearly wrong, and they had to leave things out to try to show that. It occurs to me and a lot of other people, due to the aftermath, that this was about garnering public support for clandestine oil wars. There's no question that Iraq was about oil. There's a lot of conjecture that Afghanistan's about oil also because of the Caspian area above it. And there was supposed to be a pipeline put through there. It hasn't gone through yet, but that was the intent for years. Oil seems to be the problem. And, you know, we are still, even though with our food, we've learned to do that renewably quite a while ago. So we don't fight about food in general. But naturally occurring oil, we're still hunter-gatherers. We're looking for the wild patch of oil here or there. And then it seems we're fighting about it. Now, most people wouldn't support a war for oil, per se. So that's what I think 9/11 was about, to get us to support the use of our military, both the American and British militaries, for clandestine oil wars.
Sure. But as I said to you before we started the interview, that isn't it slightly one-dimensional to put it all down to oil when we consider somebody, for example, as Zbigniew Brzezinski, who says that, you know, whoever controls the Middle Eastern area basically controls the world. Isn't it bigger than just oil?
Well, actually, when you say that, what's in the Middle East predominantly? It's oil. And if you control that, yeah, you control the world. So I still come back to oil being the major reason that this kind of thing would be pulled to garner public support for action. In the United States, quite often some politician has been heard to say, oh, that's a national security issue, I can't say anything. I think that's generally a euphemism for oil supplies. It's an overriding concern. Our societies are very dependent on oil. I mean, it's been, you know, it did a lot for us. I'm not going to argue that. I'm not total anti-oil. I'm saying I don't want to have wars over it. And we're coming back to what the average person can do. Other than the political thing, I'm trying to apply political pressure. And I think supporting renewable energies, and that has both the political component as well as an individual ideal. You know, renewable energy, we can make all the electric we can ever need in a number of ways. Windmills, wave buoys, hydroelectric, river turbines, tidal turbines, things like that, as well as solar panels and solar trowels, the parabolic dishes, the heat of fluid in their focus for heating water, making steam. All you have to do is turn a turbine in some way or another, either hydraulically or with steam. We don't need oil or even coal to do that. There's a lot of other ways. You know, that's what people can do to remove the concentration of power. The other thing, Mahatma Gandhi said something I thought was quite appropriate for the average person. He said, of course you realize this, but he said, no matter how insignificant you believe what you can do is, it's important that you do it. Because a lot of little actions finally create large actions. We can't continue to fight over diminishing resources. That's, you know, do we want to go back to the insanity of World War II? You know, I think most people would answer that no.
Well, I very much hope you're right, that we won't continue along that line. And, I mean, as you say, what can we do other than to act individually and in groups, if we can form groups to try to change things? And you say each little action counts, doesn't it? Absolutely. And so that's, I suppose, what we've been doing here, just two people having a conversation, and who knows what influence that will have. So, Tony, I have to say thank you very much indeed for joining us on the program. I'm very glad that colleague of yours did get in touch with me and that you agreed to come on, because I think that what you've presented today, and considering the detailed criticisms of NIST's work that we heard from Kevin Ryan actually back in the summer as well, I think that we now have very, very good reason to be extremely suspicious about NIST's work in this area. And I very much hope that your efforts to hold NIST and all various individuals within NIST to account will be successful, and that the truth about 9/11 will become much, much more clear to all of us, and that it will become more socially acceptable as well to ask questions about it. And I hope that this interview will inspire all of us to do what we can, whatever it is we can do, to help bring that about. So thank you, Tony, for coming on, and I wish you every blessing in your continued work.
I appreciate that, Julian, and it was a pleasure to be on with you.